قال علي عليه السلام: الاستغناء عن العذر أعز من الصدق به.
Imam Ali said, "Not to be in need of putting forth an excuse is better than putting forth a true excuse." Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us on the program. You're listening to IRIB English Radio, the programs to my brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. So, dear friends, it is evident to everyone that Imam Ali alayhi salam was the most pious of his time. Of course, when the Holy Prophet of Islam was alive, he was the second most pious. But after the passing of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, we find, of course, that in Imam Ali's own time, he was the most pious person. It is interesting, but Imam Ali alayhi salam has left behind a heritage of beautiful and profound night prayers and moving supplications. Of course, supplications such as the supplication of Dua-e Kumail. It is recorded in history that Imam Ali was so devoted in his prayers, in his namaz, in his salah, that he didn't pay attention to anything but Allah. And so, dear friends, this itself is a very important and critical point. If we want to be the best kind of Muslims, if we want to become mu'mineen, those of a higher standard of faith and iman, then we must pay attention to our prayers, our supplications, and if possible, our night prayers. These night prayers which have been highly encouraged in Islam. But of course, before we get to the night prayers, we must be able to have mastery over the daily wajib, the obligatory prayers, right? The fajr and the dhuhr and asr, the maghrib and the isha. These wajib prayers must be performed by a devoted Muslim, a devoted believer, a pious human being who is a follower of Islam. And here again we find that two of the things that we learned from Imam Ali, of course, is this emphasis on prayers. And historically, you will find in many places where the companions of Imam Ali really wondered about his being steadfast upon prayers, that too at their prescribed times. Not later or the qada, the lapsed times, but at their prescribed times, that Imam Ali was always at the forefront of fulfilling these prayers. And of course, if we look at Dua-e Kumail, this supplication that is read on Thursday nights, we will find that it is a very moving, a very profound, and in it of itself is a spiritual journey for anyone who decides to read this Dua-e Kumail. Profound lessons which we learn from the universal persona of Imam Ali: to keep up our prayers and to supplicate to Allah with our heart and our soul. Again, beautiful lessons brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم إني أسألك الأمان يوم لا ينفع مال ولا بنون إلا من أتى الله بقلب سليم.
O Allah, I ask you for the protection on the day when property will not avail, nor sons except he who comes with a heart free from evil.
وأسألك الأمان يوم يعض الظالمون يقول يا ليتني اتخذت مع الرسول سبيلا.
And I ask you for protection on the day when the unjust one will bite his hands, saying, Oh, would that I had taken away with the messenger.
وأسألك الأمان يوم يعرف المجرمون بسيماهم فيؤخذ بالنواصي والأقدام.
And I ask you for protection on the day when the guilty shall be recognized by their marks, so they shall be seized by the forelocks and the feet.
وأسألك الأمان يوم لا يجزي والد عن ولده ولا مولود هو جاز عن والده شيئا إن وعد الله حق.
And I ask you for protection on the day when a father shall not give any satisfaction for his son, nor shall the child give any satisfaction for his father. Surely the promise of Allah is true.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
Ali was even kind to the enemies. There are so many examples we have in his life. And inshallah tomorrow we'll discuss even more about it. But how was the attitude of Amir al-Mu'mineen in dealing with the enemies, let alone those who were friends? Look at the case of Ibn Muljim. And some of the young people have difficulty in understanding that Amir al-Mu'mineen knew Ibn Muljim and what is he and what are his intentions. There was a time when Ibn Muljim was there to collect the monthly distribution from Baytul Mal, and his name was also there in the list. And Amir al-Mu'mineen was standing there looking at the distribution of the Baytul Mal, the money being given out to the people. And he noticed Ibn Muljim in the line, and he says to one of his companions, "Uridu hayatuhu wa yuridu qatli." I desire his life, But he is looking forward to my murder. And so this fellow says that if that is the case, Amir al-Mu'minin, you know what are his intentions, you know, why don't you just arrest him? And this is where justice comes in. He says he has not yet committed the crime. Ali knew about it, not because of the normal channels of the spies and this and that. No, this was ilm al-ghayb. And we get this question sometimes that, you know, if he knew, why didn't he stop? This is where we have to realize, and just to make it very brief, to have ilm al-ghayb is actually an extra burden on these awliya of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. They are given the knowledge of the unseen, the thoughts and the minds of the people, what they have in their minds and their thoughts, but they are not allowed to use it when it comes to themselves. They can only use the ilm given to them if they have to prove the truth of the madhab or the claim of imamat. They cannot use it for their own personal issues. And that makes their imtihan, their test and trial even more difficult. It's easy for us to go through a difficulty and challenging, not knowing what is in the next step, next day or next week. But if you know because of the supernatural means of knowledge that given to you, still you are going through the natural cause and effect in life, that becomes even more challenging and difficult. And Amir al-Mu'mineen, you know, didn't do that.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Around the world with reporters.
So far, largest COVID vaccination center in east of Iran. Based in the northeastern city of Mashhad, the medical facility has the capacity to inoculate a whopping 10,000 people every day. The privately owned facility was launched with the attendance of state officials in Mashhad.
This facility offers the space and infrastructure needed to conduct the vaccination. The vaccines and vaccinators will be provided by the health ministry.
Iran has so far vaccinated roughly 7 million people. That's less than 10% of the population. This as the resurgence of the coronavirus in more lethal forms like the Delta variant has been killing an average of 500 Iranians every day. The new Iranian administration, led by President Raisi, has vowed to import millions of vaccines in the coming months. And Parliament says it's ready to offer any help to achieve this goal.
The President has tasked the Foreign Ministry with negotiating with different countries over the purchase of 60 million doses of COVID vaccines. We hope that this can be achieved by early October. If this happens, we could vaccinate all of the most vulnerable groups within the next 2 months.
In addition to the import of foreign vaccines, Iran is also trying to ramp up the production of domestically made jabs, such as Coviran, which has so far injected more than 1.5 million doses in the country. Nura and Cov Pars are among the local vaccines that are expected to hit the market in the next few months.
Figures show that every 3 minutes, one Iranian dies of the coronavirus. And this is not the peak yet. Now, as vaccination is viewed as the ultimate terminator of the pandemic, Iran says it will build more such vaccination centers across the country to speed up the so far sluggish inoculation trend in Iran. Yusuf Jalali from the holy city of Mashhad.
Fury raging in the streets of Pakistan on the International Day of Enforced Disappearances that originated in military dictatorship, but the practice continued in subsequent civilian governments. Victims' families are outraged at Khan administration's inaction over what they call the state kidnapping. Their only request from the government is to prosecute their loved ones in the court of law and follow the due process if they have breached any law. The protest was organized by Human Rights Commission of Pakistan.
Today we are here in front of Karachi Press Club. As you know, all from all nations, people are here in different regions of Pakistan. They are demanding for the safe release of their loved ones. I am also a victim of enforced disappearance. My father has been kidnapped by the secret state, secret forces when he was on his duty.
First post 9/11 reported cases of enforced disappearances was Dr. Afia Siddiqui, who was kidnapped along with her three children in 2003 from the streets of Karachi by CIA with the help of local secret services.
We arranged combined march, united march, along with Shia missing persons, Sindhi missing persons, Baloch missing persons, Pakhtun missing persons. Victim families are sitting here outside the governor house, and they are demanding that if someone is guilty, then give him a trial, fair and free trial in the courts of Pakistan.
We, the Sindhi and the Baloch and the Shia missing persons, Pashtun missing persons are protesting here. We held a march from Gora Kabristan to here, our governor house. We are demanding here from the Riyasat that where are our people, where are our workers, where are our nationalists who are belong with some kind of parties.
Enforced disappearances is a chronic human rights violation in Pakistan, with more than 7,000 complaints of enforced disappearances since 2011, where the real number might be much higher than the official figure. Mohammad Turi, Karachi.
The International Organization for Migration says Yemen is suffering from the world's worst humanitarian crisis, as more than 15 million Yemenis have no access to safe water and sanitation. The organization maintained it reached 2.1 million of those in need of water and hygiene services.
The war and the siege on Yemen have had a significant impact on the water infrastructure and led to the destruction of a large number of water facilities and sewage treatment plants in Yemen. There are actually a large number of Yemenis who do not have access to clean water, but not at this scale.
Health officials say lack of access to sanitation is the main reason for the spread of cholera that killed thousands of Yemenis, including children, since its outbreak in 2016. They said the new figures herald a new wave of cholera if the international organizations keep turning a blind eye to the catastrophic situation in Yemen.
There are many water and sanitation projects which have been suspended, either partially or completely, as a result of the war and siege imposed on our country. Most of the organizations do not remain committed to their pledges. The UNICEF is supposed to provide clean water to Yemenis to prevent from a new wave of cholera epidemic and other diseases such as dengue fever and malaria.
Saudi Arabia, along with its regional allies, launched a devastating war on Yemen in March 2015 and imposed an all-out blockade on the war-torn country. The United Nations describes Yemen as the world's worst man-made humanitarian crisis.
Millions of Yemenis, including children, are at risk of facing a new wave of cholera since they are unable to reach safe water. This has taken place amid the silence of the international organizations. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Young and old, men and women from all walks of life have gathered on the outskirts of Kashmir's summer capital, Srinagar, to commemorate Yom Hussein, or the Day of Imam Hussein. This is one of the events organized across Kashmir Valley every year during the Muslim calendar month of Muharram to discuss the significance of Imam Hussein's sacrifice to uphold Islamic teachings, truth and justice. The event brings together more than 100 Islamic scholars from different parts of Kashmir.
Imam Hussein's personality cannot be defined. We have tried for the last 1400 years to carry forward his teachings and his values. And with passing time, we have seen more and more people are joining the caravan of Hussein. Imam Hussein is an epitome of greatness, and his sacrifice for Islamic teachings and values teaches the way forward. The first step is unity among Muslims.
The scholars urge the youth to go deep into the pages of Islamic history to understand the sacrifices Imam Hussein made.
Imam Hussein, Muharram and Karbala have a message, and we have come to promote that message. The events of Karbala teaches us to be steadfast. They teach us the values of sacrifice for truth. They teach us not to give up and not to bow down. They teach us how Imam Hussein and his companions won the battle of Karbala, despite losing their lives. Today, 1400 years have passed, and we have carried the events of Karbala in our hearts and will carry it to our younger generation and won't let anyone forget the greatest sacrifice for the humanity.
The Islamic scholars also reminded people of plots being hatched by enemies of Islam and urged Muslims to stay united.
The enemies of Islam intend to divide us across communal lines. The majority of non-Muslims think Shias and Sunnis are at odds. They call Shia Muslims Husseinis and Sunni Muslims Mohammedans. And this is deliberate. It is aimed at creating a rift among Muslims to divide us, to divide our faith. Hussein alayhi salam is Prophet Muhammad's grandson. So how come we are divided? Such conferences aim to enlighten people about the nefarious designs of enemies and to teach the importance of unity among Muslims.
Religious scholars say the Battle of Karbala was a defining moment in the history of Islam that continues to inspire people regardless of their religion. And the real tribute to the martyrs of Karbala would be to follow their path in letter and spirit. Shahana Bhatt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hussein Amir Abdullahian arrived in Damascus on Sunday. He sat down with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and discussed with him steps taken by both sides to enhance bilateral cooperation with the aim of reaching a higher level of partnership in economy and trade. In the meeting, Assad reaffirmed that the ongoing cooperation between the two countries had positive results in terms of protecting the interests of the two peoples, mainly in fighting terrorism. Abdullahian, for his part, briefed Assad on the outcome of the Baghdad Cooperation and Partnership Conference. He asserted that Iran will continue to support Syria in fighting all forms of terror, mainly economic terrorism.
Both countries are working on a roadmap to develop relations as well as trade and economic cooperation to tackle the sanctions imposed on them. We discussed the latest developments in the region. Improving economic cooperation between both countries' private sector is an important issue which both sides regard as crucial.
The Iranian official also held a separate meeting with his Syrian counterpart Faisal al-Maqdad. They discussed regional and international developments, saying that foreign presence in the region will not bring security and stability. Maqdad underlined the importance of steadfastness in the face of all Western plots and pressure in order to achieve victory.
We discussed bilateral relations, the situation in Syria and Iran, as well as mutual challenges, the steadfastness of Syria and Iran, as well as all those who want to achieve justice, freedom, sovereignty, and independence in our world, will lead them to victory over terrorism and those who question our capability to face challenges.
Abdullahian concluded his meetings by holding talks with heads of Syria-based Palestinian factions, renewing Iran's support for Palestinians' struggle and their fight for their legitimate rights. Mr. Abdullahian's visit comes shortly after the formation of the new cabinet in Iran. The visit is a reiteration of Iran's steadfast stance towards Syria, based on support to the government and people in the fight on terror and for rebuilding the country. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
In a press conference, Palestinian resistance groups in the Gaza Strip declared the return of nighttime protests, also known as night confusion operations along the buffer zone, to reject the Israeli blockade on the enclave.
It is time to end this crippling siege completely. We gave the mediators many chances to end this siege, and there are no more chances for any delay. Our people have got enough of this suffering. We will not leave our positions and won't stop the confrontation until Israel ends the blockade. Israeli settlers nearby won't witness peace as long as our people are not living in peace. We won't stay silent over the misery our people live in.
Palestinian protesters staged a demonstration near the buffer zone, burning tires and launching incendiary balloons at the Israeli army. The demonstrators were voicing their anger at the deteriorating quality of life in the Gaza Strip, caused by a crippling Israeli blockade since 2007. On Saturday, 13-year-old Omar Hassan Abu Nil died of injuries after being shot by the Israeli soldiers during an anti-Israeli protest held a week before.
If the Israeli regime keeps committing these crimes against our people, we will continue the fight and confront the regime here. Israel should know that we are only fighting for our right to live a decent life. This is our land, and we won't leave it, no matter the cost.
Palestinian Resistance Front says it will escalate clashes with Israel as long as the regime keeps its suffocating siege on Gaza, hampering life in the impoverished enclave. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
State security forces on standby in Washington, D.C. were activated today as Palestinians marched toward the White House to condemn the first meeting between U.S. President Joe Biden and Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett. That summit was ultimately postponed after a series of bombing attacks in Afghanistan, but protesters were quickly driven out of Lafayette Park regardless. They denounced not just the heavy-handed police tactics, but also President Biden's decision to host Bennett and his refusal to hold Israel accountable for its crimes against Palestinian people.
You're really violating our constitutional rights. To express ourselves okay. In front of the administration, to the administration,
sir.
And you're just using your power to ask us to.
Let us say that we're here to condemn this visit by this war criminal, the new Israeli Prime Minister, Bennett. He's calling for a war with Iran. He wants a new war against the Gaza Strip. He's not here with a proposal to give the Palestinians their rights.
In a symbolic move, the protesters made their way to the Willard Hotel, where the Israeli Prime Minister is staying, and read aloud the names and ages of Palestinians recently killed by the regime.
Mira Rami Abula, 12. Yadan Rami Abula, 13. Amir Rami Abula, 9.
With Israel stepping up its economic and military siege on the Gaza Strip once again, activists all over the world have renewed their efforts to mobilize for Palestinian liberation. But many say it's right here in D.C. that Israel's real base of power lies.
The police aren't letting demonstrators anywhere near the White House. They are keeping Palestinians and their supporters at least 2 blocks away, but that has not kept organizers from staying on the move. They say they won't stop until the Biden administration stops being complicit in Israeli war crimes. Wyatt Reed, Washington.
The holiday season has ended, but the protests against the mandatory health pass are continuing. Only in Paris, 3 different marches took place, dozens all over France. The health pass is an electronic document that people have to show before entering public places. Medical figures show that in areas with more than 70% of people vaccinated, the transmission of the virus and the death qualities are very low. But many people continue to protest because they do not trust the government discourse.
I absolutely don't believe in what they say. We are facing dishonest people, liars. These people want to suppress our liberties and control us.
For me, there is something fishy going on here. I do not have any trust in this vaccine.
But medical figures seem to show the opposite. Today, end of August, 65% of the French population has received 2 jabs of the anti-COVID vaccine. The French health minister, Olivier Véran, himself a neurologist, administered an injection in front of the cameras. He said that people should fear the virus, not the vaccine. French officials say that the COVID crisis is getting under control thanks to the accelerated vaccination campaign and some mandatory measures. In French overseas territories, however, like Martinique, La Réunion or Guadeloupe, The situation is getting out of control because less than 30% of the people there are vaccinated. COVID infections and death casualties are high. Hospitals are full and the lockdown and curfew have been extended. Today, more than 90% of people who arrive in hospitals with severe symptoms of the COVID virus or who die from the virus are non-vaccinated persons. But the mistrust in the vaccine remains high.
Why do they force me to be injected with an unknown product, a pseudo-experimental vaccine? Normally, a vaccine is first tested on animals, then on volunteers. Today, the government threatens and blackmails an entire population. Restaurant workers and health personnel can be fired.
Hospital workers are now obliged to be vaccinated or have to show a negative PCR test. If not, they will be suspended without salary. Most of the protesters do not deny that the vaccination campaign in France seems to be successful, but they would like the French government to use the method of persuasion rather than a restriction. Chris Den Hunt, Paris.
A scene of desperation transformed into one of horror in the waning days of the U.S.-led occupation. Two terrorist attacks on Kabul airport, claimed by Daesh. Dozens killed, among them children and U.S. troops. Hundreds more injured. British troops were spared this time. The U.K. Prime Minister says he's sticking to the evacuation plans.
The military, the Foreign Office teams, the Home Office, the Border Force teams are there, getting people through as fast as they can still. And we're going to keep going up until the last moment.
That last moment comes on August 31st. Thousands, including British troops and eligible Afghans, are yet to be evacuated, and the threat of more attacks is looming. Pressure on the government over its handling of the crisis is mounting.
The Foreign Secretary shouts now, but he stayed on holiday while our mission in Afghanistan was disintegrating. You cannot coordinate an international response from the beach.
It's a shambolic end to a 20-year-long U.S.-led occupation, leaving ordinary Afghans to fend for themselves in a country torn by decades of war.
They invaded on a pretext, which was a false pretext, and then for 20 years they've spent $2 to $3 trillion destroying that country. The future in that regard is tough for the Afghani people. They're starting from a very low base as one of the poorest countries on earth, but there are resourceful, ingenious people who are well capable of lifting themselves out of their current situation.
The UK followed the US and their NATO allies into Afghanistan in 2001, purportedly to topple the Taliban, only to hand the country back to the militant group two decades later.
Imperialism invades for reasons of extraction of material wealth, to dominate markets, to dominate labor, to dominate resources. They had a geostrategic policy to dominate the oil of that region. Forget their talk about green energy. They want to extract the maximum fossil fuels from the Middle East and dominate every government, any government which stands in their way and is non-compliant.
The Kabul airport attacks will probably not be the last ones. A taste of what to expect in post-occupation Afghanistan.
Experts say what's happening in Afghanistan right now is another crisis created by an illegal war waged by the U.S., the U.K., and other NATO countries. Another example that military invasion or intervention is not conducive to stability or lasting peace. Saeed Pariza, London.
Turkey still seems to be undecided over the issue of the Kabul airport. The Turkish president said Ankara is still yet to decide on a request by the Taliban to run the airport. This came in a presser held in Atatürk Airport ahead of a trip the president is taking to Sarajevo. After Turkey's decision to withdraw troops located at the Kabul airport, the Taliban asked Turkey's assistance in operating the airport. Ankara says it isn't against the idea. However, there are certain things that the Taliban should provide first, such as securing the airport, especially after the latest bombing that took place on Thursday.
The Taliban have made a request regarding the operation of Kabul airport. They say we'll ensure security and you can operate it. But we have not made a decision yet because there's always the possibility of death and such things there.
Turkish president said the hesitation is due to several factors. The main one is the current power vacuum, assuring that a decision will be made once a new government is formed. and security is prevailed in Afghanistan. He added that commercial flights to Kabul will not be resumed now. Turkey urged the Taliban earlier to form an inclusive government, which includes former Afghan leaders. Ankara said those politicians have a certain credibility internationally and would help in ensuring political stability. Turkey is currently working to evacuate its citizens from Afghanistan. However, it seems that Ankara plans to accept Taliban's offer to run the airport, assuring that it is very important to keep the airport functioning to help receive aid supplies. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The presence of extremist militant groups in Africa is providing the perfect pretext for expanding the U.S. military footprint there. The U.S. desperately needs new leadership before it bleeds another generation in an endless war. We now present you an article written by Brandon J. Weichert, the author of Winning Space, How America Remains a Superpower. The piece is titled Afghanistan Today, Africa Tomorrow, America's Saga of Failure. The article has been published by the Asia Times Daily. Recent heartbreaking images from Kabul prove the Americans have lost the war. This just a few short years after they lost Iraq. Like it did in Iraq in 2003, the United States went after extremist militants in Afghanistan, but it hung around for 20 years trying vainly to remake ancient Afghanistan into a protectorate of the United States. Rather than ask why these conflicts resulted in staggering defeats for the United States, America's bipartisan ruling elite appear interested only in whitewashing these catastrophic failures by switching the focus now to Africa. The U.S. is barely out of Afghanistan. Its failure is so pronounced that it is leaving many of its own citizens in that country to the tender mercies of the Taliban. And many in Washington are already seeking to replicate the pattern of failure that resulted in America's profound defeat in Afghanistan in Africa. In 2017, as the Donald Trump administration was settling into what would become a chaotic presidency, the 33rd Joint Land, Air and Sea Strategic Special Program was conducted, which included 148 students from the U.S. military's various war colleges. The war game scenario was set in the period from 2023 to 2026. It detailed a coordinated terrorist attack on the New York and New Jersey ends of the Lincoln Tunnel, killing 435 people and injuring an additional 618. A cyber attack against a nuclear power plant in Berwick, Pennsylvania, occurs as well. There are also several follow-on attacks conducted against targets throughout Africa, the Canadian embassy in Mauritania, and suicide bombings in Nigeria. It is soon determined that Al-Qaeda in Maghreb, or AQIM, is responsible for the coordinated, sophisticated wave of terrorist attacks. It should be noted that Boko Haram today is far more dangerous than Al-Qaeda in Maghreb or AQIM, though this is a distinction without much of a difference. Under the metrics of the war game, the fictional 46th President of the United States, an unconventional politician whose presidency is buffeted by a seemingly endless string of crises, commits the United States to a massive military response directed against Al-Qaeda in Maghreb or AQIM in Mauritania. This fictional president is as much a stand-in for America's current bombing president, Joe Biden, as it was for the tumultuous former president, Donald Trump. In the war game from 2017, the U.S. president promises resolve and a well-planned short conflict meant to decimate AQIM. Instead, just as with Afghanistan, Iraq, and countless other counterinsurgency wars, the Americans get bogged down for years after the initial invasion in 2023. Just as U.S. servicemen and women experienced in Iraq and Afghanistan, the fighting with Al-Qaeda in Maghreb, or AQIM, is not constrained to the national boundaries of Mauritania. It transcends that nation and encompasses the neighboring countries of Mali and Algeria. And just as Iraq in 2003 became a magnet attracting the extremist militants from the so-called Greater Middle East, the U.S.-led fight against Al-Qaeda in Maghreb, or AQIM, attracts militants from around the world. The U.S.-led coalition in Mauritania eventually becomes stymied by the transnational nature of the war, just as the real-world coalitions were in both Afghanistan and Iraq. The pattern of those two failed wars repeat again when, in 2025, the Americans try to hand off the war to the locals, in this case the African Union, and it goes as disastrously wrong as the other wars did. The longer the war drags on with the U.S. and allied forces directly involved, the more diffuse the terrorist threat becomes. Al-Qaeda in Maghreb, or AQIM's success against the Americans, reinvigorates Boko Haram, just as American intervention in Iraq propagated Daesh terrorists, al-Nusra terrorists, and a host of other Takfiri terror groups throughout the wider region. The war is inconclusive, and by 2026, U.S. allies are withdrawing, and Washington is yet again at a terrible crossroads. Does it double down on failure and ensure the endless war, this time in West Africa, drags on for decades longer? Or does it suffer another humiliating defeat at the hands of extremist militants. Don't you think this is on America's plate after Afghanistan? Just look at the last few months of the Biden administration. Over the summer, President Biden ordered the largest strike against militants of al-Shabaab in Somalia. Further, as he was rightly taking flak for this horrific evacuation plan in Afghanistan, Joe Biden took to the airwaves to insist that the real fight in the so-called global war on terror was no longer in Afghanistan and West Asia. Instead, Biden argued, the center of gravity in the war has now shifted to Africa. Beyond that, the Biden administration's shadow president, Susan Rice, cut her teeth in Africa policy. The region has been an area of great concern for Susan Rice for years. What's more, over the past decade, the U.S. foreign policy establishment has been concerned by the growth of Chinese power and influence in the African continent. More recently, the head of U.S. Africa Command, or AFRICOM, has fretted over the rise of Russian groups throughout Africa. Washington has become awash with experts insisting that the U.S. is losing Africa to its rivals, and the presence of Al-Qaeda in Maghreb, or AQIM, and other extremist militant groups provides the perfect pretext for expanding America's military footprint there, especially as the graybeards in Washington seek to shift the narrative from Afghanistan. While the threat of extremist militants in Africa is indeed growing, and both Chinese and Russian influence in Africa relative to that of the United States is troubling, Joe Biden and his team must avoid the siren song of military intervention in Africa. Although the fact that the U.S. security state has been preparing for an Afghanistan in West Africa, with the presence of Africa hawks like Susan Rice being nestled inside the Biden administration, it is more than likely that soon the United States will be as committed to nation building in West Africa as it was in both Afghanistan and Iraq, with similarly disastrous consequences. The U.S. desperately needs new leadership before it bleeds another generation in an endless war.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
Axel Jawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatih al-Jinan, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين.
My name is Sheikh Zaid Al Salami.
A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah al-Uzma al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. We know that in Islam, knowledge is very, very important. We know that there's a very strong emphasis on pursuing knowledge, seeking knowledge, gaining as much knowledge as we can, especially when the knowledge is beneficial, especially when the knowledge is going to give you proximity and closeness to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Man ihtaqara, Rasulullah says, man ihtaqara sahib al-ilm faqad ihtaqarani wa man ihtaqarani fahuwa kafir. If you disrespect a bearer of knowledge, then you are disrespecting me. And if you are disrespecting me, you're not a Muslim, you are a disbeliever. And what about a alim bila amal, or alim, a person of knowledge, when we say alim, automatically our mind needs to go to the positive meaning of alim. Now, as for those who are bearers of knowledge, scientific knowledge, Imam Sadiq says, ليس العلم بكثرة التعليم والتعلم العلم نور يقذفه الله في قلبي من يشاء. Nabiullah Isa, Prophet Jesus, Salamullahi alayh, has said, Al dinaru da'ud deen, that dinar, the currency, the money, is the sickness of religion. Wal alimu tabibul deen, an alim is a physician of religion. And if you see the tabib, this alim, acquiring or attracting or bringing or pursuing this sickness of money to himself, فَتَّهِمُوهُ, then put a big question mark on this person, that this person is not going to be someone who can give advice to someone else. وَإِيَّاكُمْ, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, he says, be careful, be aware, be cautious of the ignorant muta'abbid, those who do ibadah out of ignorance. They just do it the ritualistic kind of way and have absolutely no understanding what they are doing. And also be careful of the corrupt ulama, because they are the source of fitna and sedition. When we look at this, we can understand from all of these sayings that the one condition for a alim is to be reluctant in any way to draw himself or herself to matters of dunya, to be someone who is avoiding, someone who stays away from any matters or any affairs of dunya. Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, he says, fuqaha are the trustees of the prophets, as long as they don't engage themselves in affairs of dunya. That he was asked, what do you mean by them entering into affairs of dunya? He said, by them following the ruler, succumbing to the ruler. Of course, we're talking about the corrupt ruler, the evil ruler. And if they were to do that, if they were to become among those who follow the corrupt rulers, then be cautious of them in the affairs of your religion.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes.
یه جلدش هی مفاتیح الجنان است چه فلان نماز قصاب داره فلان روزه نماز.
One volume, the present volume, مفاتیح الجنان, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc.
یه جلدش کم داره و اون اینه که فلان درختکاری اینجا کم ثواب داره, دعا هم داره, ثواب هم داره.
But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree.
امام اونطوری که اینو گفته بودم گفته دی اون امامش گفته اگر روزه بگیری ثواب داره, همون امام گفته که اگر درخت بکاری اون ثواب داره.
Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam who has stressed out the reward for praying has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree.
محیط زیست سالم نگه داره این دو ثواب داره.
There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment.
وقتی میخوای کشاورزی کنی یه قد گندم بگیر رو به قبله بیست این دعا رو بخون, این هم همه امام گفته دیگه.
When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned.
تو نظام اسلامی این جلد دوم جاش خالی.
We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
We all know that hadith from narrated from Imam Hassan al-Askari, attributed to Imam Hassan al-Askari, and that is the kind of qualities that we need to see. you know, someone who preserves their religion, someone who stays away from following their lusts and their desires. You know, sa'inan li nafsi, they've done, as I said, their tahdhibun nafs and things like that. And most importantly, they obey the commands of their Lord. Important thing that we can understand from all of this is that if you are someone who respects knowledge, then you honor and you respect and you revere the status of those who bear knowledge, those who hold knowledge, and those who practice that knowledge that they hold as well, which is, alhamdulillah, what we can see in most cases when it comes to our righteous ulama. And as for someone who is pursuing affairs of dunya, someone who does not in any way care about their akhlaqi side, someone who hasn't done any kind of disciplining of their nafs or things like that, then you need to be someone who avoids them, stays away from them. We also need to get into that habit of mujalasatul ulama, of sitting with ulama, of benefiting from ulama, and being patient in their presence as well, you know, and making sure that that's what you are going to be able to proudly contribute for yourself and also for your own well-being. You will be able to convey that knowledge to others as well, you know, with all that you are learning, and how vital it is to pick up on these kind of pieces of information that an experienced, knowledgeable person will be able to share with you, especially when they are qualified in that area and they do have that level of authority, which is also very, very important. So we shouldn't be tricked by names, we shouldn't be tricked by clothes and what it is that a person is wearing, but more in the sense of us making sure that we make the right selection, that we choose the right individual, because we are going to allow them to share with us affairs of our religion. And another hadith says, the same way as you are cautious about what you eat, you should also be cautious about who you gain your knowledge from. Walhamdulillahi rabbil alameen, wa salatu wa salamu ala ashrafi khalqillahi Muhammad wa alihi tahirin.
Driving past, walking fast, to the field of dreams, hear the children scream.
That was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind, a momentary emotion, space spent in time, memories fade like a dusty window pane, and you can't see your past no more. The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart that will always be there, be there.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.